Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
The Lutheran Reformation in Great Britain with Pastor Roy Long.
This is the first in a series of talks about the part played by Lutherans in the Reformation in Britain in the 16th century. In the course of these talks, we shall be looking at some of the people who were influenced by Martin Luther and who contributed to the Reformation in both England and Scotland. But while you're listening to the talks, please bear two things in mind. Firstly, I'm a Lutheran pastor and not a professional historian, which means that you may know far more about the subject than I do. And secondly, at the time we should be talking about, the word Lutheran could be used in different ways and mean different things to different people. These talks are going to be about a number of people during a time span that will cover around 70 years. And I have to confess that I've been rather subjective in the personalities that I've chosen to talk about and those that I've omitted. So, you will hear about some less well-known people, such as Thomas Bilney and John Frith, whereas you will only hear in passing about more famous people like William Tyndale and Thomas Cranmer. On Saturday the 21st of April 1509, the first Tudor monarch of England, Henry VII, died. And he was succeeded by his second son, Henry, Prince of Wales, and the whole country probably breathed a collective sigh of relief. After half a century of civil war between rival factions of the royal family of Plantagenet, Henry VII had seized the throne in 1485 after defeating Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. And, by marrying into the rival Yorkist branch of the royal family, had appeared to unite the country once again. But Henry Tudor lacked charisma. Not only was he lackluster and dull, but he was a miserly penny-pincher who devised countless means to increase the royal revenues at the expense of his subjects. Now he was dead, and England had an 18-year-old king who was lively, physically attractive, generous, and popular. Within 6 months, he had married Catherine of Aragon, widow of his dead older brother Arthur, and England seemed set fair for a time of prosperity and security. When he died, 38 years later, on the 28th of January 1547, Henry was a gross, diseased, six times married tyrant who had killed members of his family, including two of his wives, his friends, religious traditionalists and reformers, and who had separated the church in England from the Catholic Church of the West. Once again, most of the country probably breathed a sigh of relief. It is notoriously difficult, if not impossible, to describe and analyse in any simple way the complex process of the English Reformation during the reign of Henry VIII. There were many spiritual, economic, social and political factors at work during this period. But it's clear that without Henry himself, the Reformation would not have proceeded in the way that it did. It was the king and his personality which brought about the religious changes during his reign. Whether or not these changes can really be called a reformation, those who held different views from him or who opposed him, or even those who worked hard on his behalf but became overmighty, met the same fate, whether they were supporters of reform or defenders of traditional orthodoxy. Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, Sir Thomas More, Thomas Cromwell are among the many seemingly powerful figures who tasted the royal wrath. But there were many less powerful figures who perished because of their faith. Among these are Robert Barnes, Thomas Bilney, John Frith, and a host of others, including staunch traditionalist Roman Catholics such as Bishop John Fisher and the Carthusian monks of London. Martyrdom in Henry VIII's England was a truly ecumenical affair. Henry's Reformation, which appeared to change direction almost by the month, depending on need and circumstance, was governed primarily by two things. The first was his need to ensure the continuation of the Tudor dynasty through a legitimate male heir, which he was eventually able to do with the birth of Prince Edward to Queen Jane Seymour in 1538. However, to arrive at that point cost him two wives. The marriage to the first of whom, Catherine of Aragon, he had annulled on the grounds that it was wrong of him to have married his brother's widow in the first place, and the second of whom, Anne Boleyn, he had executed on the grounds of adultery and incest. In truth, they were disposed of because they had failed to produce the longed-for son, and it was this, rather than doctrinal matters, that led to the schism with Rome. The Pope, whose predecessor had provided a dispensation for Henry to marry Catherine in the first place, would not countenance an annulment, nor the subsequent, and in his eyes bigamous, marriage to Anne. The second crucial factor, which developed very obviously in the last years of his life, was Henry's increasing irascibility and unpredictability as ill health and pain overtook him. He's known to have had a badly ulcerated leg, probably caused by a jousting wound which had failed to heal, and there is also evidence of increasing severe mood swings which exacerbated an already ruthless streak in his personality. Modern scholars have suggested that towards the end of his life he suffered from a condition known as Cushing's syndrome, which is a rare endocrine abnormality, the physical symptoms of which coincide with the symptoms he's known to have had. As important as the physical symptoms are the mental ones, and in his book, The Last Days of Henry VIII, the historian Robert Hutchinson has written, "Irritability, depression, anxiety, insomnia, and sudden mood swings became commonplace in around 20% of cases. The sufferer also becomes psychotic, exhibiting a paranoia that drives a deep suspicion of everything and everyone around them. Sometimes they become emotionally detached from their loved ones or from those close to them. The victim, afflicted with recurrent headaches and chronic fatigue, is quarrelsome and frequently unnaturally aggressive." When Henry VIII ascended the throne in 1509, he ruled over a kingdom which was virtually the same in extent as today's England and Wales. Although the vast majority of Welshmen spoke Welsh, and Cornish was still the main language in the far west of England, English was now the normal language of everyday speech for all classes of Englishmen. True, there were significant differences in dialect across the country, but the work of writers such as Geoffrey Chaucer and to some extent John Wycliffe, about whom we shall be saying more in a few minutes, they had helped to ensure that the language of London and the southeast of England would become the basis for the standard written language. Religiously, the country was a part of the Western Catholic Church, owing allegiance to the Pope in Rome, believed to be the successor of St. Peter. The piety of the people was similar to that in many other countries and was characterised by such things as reverence for the saints and by going on pilgrimage. Two places in particular were pilgrimage centres. Walsingham in Norfolk, which had an important shrine dedicated to the Virgin Mary, and Canterbury, site of the murder of Thomas à Becket in the 12th century. The country was dotted with churches, and the cathedral-like parish churches in some parts of the country, such as East Anglia, testify to the wealth to be found there. All of which is not to say that there were not people who would have welcomed reform, and there were two groups in particular who in different ways foreshadowed both Luther and the first English reformers. Firstly, there were the hidden pockets of Lollards, That's to say, the spiritual descendants of the 14th century Oxford reformer John Wycliffe. These were to be found not only in parts of Henry's kingdom, but also across the border in southwestern Scotland, although none of these seem to have been very influential. More important, perhaps, was the growing influence of what is often described as the New Learning, represented by such scholars as John Collett, John Fisher, Thomas Lineker, Desiderius Erasmus, and Thomas More. In their different ways, both of these movements laid the foundation for the growth of evangelical thinking among all classes of English society in the first three decades of the 16th century. So, let's begin by looking at the first of these, John Wycliffe and the Lollards. As we've just noted, there were continuing pockets of Lollards in different parts of the country, especially in London and the southeast of England, but over the preceding century they had suffered persecution and sometimes death, because of the provisions of a law which dated from King Henry IV's day, De Hieretico Comberendo. This was a law under which persons convicted of heresy by a church court could be handed over to the secular authorities to be burned at the stake, and we know that this was applied to Wycliffe's followers at different times during the 14th century. However, small groups had managed to survive, and from time to time they came to the attention of the secular authorities. We could give several examples of this, but for the time being one will suffice, that of the London merchant Richard Hunn or Hunner. Hunner seems to have been a well-known figure in early 16th century London, and he was a member of the Guild of Merchant Tailors and also a freeman of the City of London. Apparently, he was well known for his opposition to what he saw as the excessive privileges of the contemporary clergy, although nobody seems to have thought of him as a heretic. He came into conflict with the local diocesan authorities because of an argument with a local priest who, in 1514, conducted the funeral of his child. The details don't need to concern us, but he was sued by the priest and convicted in a church court. He challenged this decision and took the matter to a secular court. In retaliation, the church authorities decided to examine him for heresy, and upon searching his house, they discovered that he owned several Lollard books, ownership of which had been forbidden for over 100 years. He was arrested and imprisoned in the Lollard's Tower at St. Paul's, where a few days later he was found hanged. The church insisted that he'd committed suicide, but it was generally believed that he'd been murdered, and this, indeed, was the verdict of the coroner's court, which laid the blame on the Chancellor of the Diocese of London. The church countered this by accusing Hunner of heresy and ordered the burning of his body. To cut a long story short, the church eventually had to back down, and Cardinal Wolsey himself had to apologise to the king for appearing to challenge the rights of the king's courts. Now, what this incident reveals is that there was certainly anti-clericalism in the early years of Henry VIII's reign, and that there was a continuing, if underground, existence of the followers of John Wycliffe. Wycliffe, who's often called the morning star of the Reformation, is seen by many writers as a forerunner of the later Protestant movement which developed in England in the reign of Henry VIII and his successors. So we might profitably have a brief look at who he was and what he taught. From the evidence that's available to us, John Wycliffe was a Yorkshireman who was born in the area of Wycliffe-on-Tees near Barnard Castle sometime between 1324 and 1329. This sets his birth in the early years of the reign of King Edward III and his death in December 1384 in the reign of Edward's grandson, Richard II. He lived out his life during a time of significant social and political change, which saw the beginning of the Hundred Years' War with France, the Black Death, the Peasants' Revolt, and the emergence of literature in vernacular English. But this was still a pre-Renaissance medieval world, and Wycliffe was, in essence, a medieval scholastic philosopher. Although we can only speculate on what Wycliffe's early life and education may have been like, we believe that he went up to Oxford in or around 1345, but we know nothing for sure until 1356, when he graduated from Merton College, and 1360, when he appears as Master of Balliol College. Between then and his death, it seems that he held various livings in absentia. In other words, he didn't live in his parishes. But he ended his life as Vicar of Lutterworth in Leicestershire, to which he was appointed in 1374. But Wycliffe was very definitely an Oxford man, and it was there that he did most of his theological and philosophical writing, writing for which he was eventually condemned by the church as heretical. He was fortunate that, during his life, he had the protection of important people about court, most notably Richard II's uncle, John of Gaunt, who was, in effect, regent of England in the early years of the young king's reign. But that didn't stop the church from condemning him. In 1377, Pope Gregory XI issued a papal bull which denounced 18 of the errors, mostly political, that had allegedly been found in his writings. And in 1382, he was condemned by the Earthquake Synod, so-called because an earthquake occurred during its deliberations, a synod held in London under the chairmanship of Thomas Courtney, Archbishop of Canterbury, an old enemy of Wycliffe. Later in that same year, on the 17th of November, Wycliffe appeared before a synod in Oxford, but the protection of friends at court ensured that he wasn't excommunicated nor removed from his living in Lutterworth. For the purposes of this talk, we don't need to go into great detail about all the ins and outs of Wycliffe's life and thought. Many of his writings are couched in the intricate language of medieval scholasticism. But there are a number of things which emerge and which arouse the hostility of contemporary churchmen and which link him to later Protestant writers. The main thing which links Wycliffe firmly with the Protestant reformers is his insistence that the scriptures should be the source of all Christian doctrine, and this prompted him to initiate a translation of the Bible into contemporary English. We don't know for certain how much of the work he was personally responsible for, and two other men, Nicholas of Hereford and John Purvey, are believed to have been involved in the translation. Purvey, who was another Oxford man, was responsible for revising the first attempt at translation and putting it into more readable English. Bearing in mind the length of the Bible, and that we're talking about a period more than half a century before the invention of a printing press with movable type, then Wycliffe's feat was truly outstanding. Using scripture as the basis for his studies, Wycliffe produced a large number of writings which reveal how estranged he had become from the theological thought of his day. He'd come to recognise how flawed that medieval scholastic theology was, and also how corrupt the contemporary church was. Wycliffe's own view of the church shows that he had a strong belief in predestination, and this led him to maintain that there was an invisible church, made up of those whom God had predestined to salvation, and a visible church, which men and women could see all around them. Consequence of this was the development of an understanding of ministry, which maintained that if a priest administering the sacraments was living an immoral life, then the sacraments were not valid. Wycliffe wanted to abolish the ministry as it was understood by the church of his day, which had a whole hierarchy of different grades of priests, many of whom were rich and prosperous. of course. There were many poor priests as well, but Wycliffe wanted a situation where that was the norm. Poor priests, who had no formal ordination, had taken no vows, but who went around two by two preaching the gospel. These were the Lollards, a name given to them in Gregory the 11th's bull. It's interesting to note the similarity between these Lollard preachers and the original friars of Francis of Assisi. By the way, the word Lollard seems to have come from a Flemish word meaning to mumble or speak in a confusing way. Wycliffe's public career corresponded partly to the early years of a schism which resulted in there being two, and at one point three, men claiming to be pope. But it's an open question as to how much he was influenced by this in his views on the popes and their role in the church. Certainly, though, we can say that his views became more radical as time went on, and the position that he eventually reached was one which asserted that only one of the elect, predestined by God to salvation, could be a valid leader of the church, and he strongly asserted that our Pope is Christ. Initially, Wycliffe's views were supported by members of the mendicant friars, but quite early on they turned against him. He could find no justification for monasticism in the Bible. Certainly, he could applaud the principles of poverty that could be seen in the lives of the monks and friars, but these were far removed from the reality of most contemporary monasteries, with their worldliness and their possessions. He believed that the monks and friars should give up these possessions and devote themselves to manual labour. Likewise, church property should be secularised. Wycliffe denied the doctrine of transubstantiation, which held that, although the elements of bread and wine used in the Lord's Supper continued to look like bread and wine after consecration, that's to say, the external accidents remained the same, their internal nature, their essence, became the body and blood of Christ. In a book called De Eucharistia, Wycliffe challenged this doctrine and put forward an alternative view. So it's easy to see how Wycliffe could arise opposition among many churchmen, and this was not long in coming. But he was fortunate in the support he had from some of the most powerful men in the kingdom, and so long as he was alive, they protected him, and he died peacefully enough in Lutterworth in 1384, where he was buried in the churchyard. Many of his followers were less fortunate, and over the decades that followed, many were arrested and burned at the stake. The Catholic Church's final verdict came at the Council of Constance in 1415, when no less than 267 errors, supposedly to be found in his writings, were condemned. And the order was given not only that his books should be burned, but his bones should be dug up and burned as well. Wycliffe and the Lollards represented a desire for a radical reform of the church, and they challenged many of the fundamental beliefs of the Catholic Church. But there were other, more moderate reformers who had begun to come to the fore in the two decades before Henry VIII ascended the throne in 1509, and who would grow more influential as time went on. Among the earliest of these, and arguably one of the most important, was John Colet, who from 1505 until his death in 1519 was Dean of St Paul's Cathedral in London. Colet's father, Sir Henry Colet, who may originally have come from Buckinghamshire, was a prominent London merchant who twice held the post of the city's Lord Mayor. John was born in London in 1466 or 1467, presumably had the typical education of a boy of his class, and eventually went up to Oxford, probably to Magdalen College. We know for certain that he graduated as Master of Arts in 1490 and some 2.5 years later set out on a sort of grand tour around Europe. He spent some time in Paris before moving on to Italy, learning all the time. This was his first exposure to the new learning of the Renaissance, and during his travels he seems to have learned Greek and to have been exposed to the very radical teachings of Girolamo Savonarola, who tried to reform Florence, and who had turned the city upside down with his fiery preaching before eventually being hanged in 1498. In 1496, Colet returned to Oxford, where he was ordained as a deacon, and began lecturing on the Epistles of St. Paul. It was clear from the outset that his style and method were quite different from that of the scholastic theologians who had dominated both universities. They interpreted the scriptures using mystical and allegorical methods, whereas Colet believed that his task was to find out what was in Paul's mind, what he was really trying to say, and what were the historical circumstances in which he said them. This approach, which is actually the one which most biblical scholars use today, was fresh and had important implications for individual Christians living in the wider community. The Church had tended to use biblical texts simply as proofs of its doctrines and moral rules, but Colet looked at the Bible in a much broader context. He saw that there were personal implications involved, and in his lectures he called on Christians to return to the discipline that had characterized the early Church. The obvious implication of this was that the Church of his day was in urgent need of reform. But his ideas of reform were not radical in the ways that those of either Wycliffe or Savonarola were. His were moderate, and though it was suggested on a couple of occasions that he was himself a heretic, he never attacked any of the basic teachings of the Church. In 1505, Colet was appointed to be Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, where he was, of course, required to preach regularly in the cathedral, and contemporary reports testify to his skill as a preacher. Some of his sermons were controversial, and two are well known and testify to his personal bravery. The first of these was delivered on the 6th of February 1512 to the convocation of the province of Canterbury at the invitation of the then Archbishop of Canterbury, William Warham. In this sermon, Colet called for a radical reform of some of the Church's institutions. He began by criticising the lifestyle of many priests in his day. Instead of being beacons of light in the world around them, their lives, which he said were full of pride and sin and covetousness, love of worldly things, made them figures of darkness. What was needed were priests who were humble, poor and ascetic servants, men who turned their backs on wealth and who were truly capable of being intermediaries between human beings and their God. Above all, he said, they should be literate in the scriptures and able to preach and administer the sacraments, calling their people to live lives that were spiritual, humble, sober and charitable. There was no need, he felt, for new spiritual laws to be enacted, but instead those that already existed should be properly adhered to. He's clear that a true reform of the Church had to start with its ordained priests, and this echoes some words of the great English poet of 100 years before, Geoffrey Chaucer, who in his poem The Canterbury Tales had praised a poor priest on pilgrimage to Canterbury and had posed a question about clergy in general. If gold rusts, what shall iron do? 1 year later, on Good Friday 1513, Colet, who was one of the king's chaplains, preached a sermon at court in which he opposed plans for renewing the war against the French. King Henry was himself in the congregation, And had it happened later on in his reign, there is no doubt that Colet would have been putting himself in great danger. But these were the days when Henry was more tolerant of opposition, and Colet managed to retain his post. Colet was, above all, an educator. And very early on in his time as Dean of St. Paul's, he established the practice of theological lectures in the cathedral 3 times a week. But he is perhaps best known for refounding St. Paul's School, which he endowed with some of the money left to him at his father's death in 1508. The school was to be open to any deserving boy, and the pupils were given a solid Christian and classical education, which not only included traditional instruction in Latin, but also in Greek. Now, this talk is primarily concerned with the contributions of British reformers. But because it was very much part of Catholic Europe, the England of the first Tudor kings was also part of an international intellectual community. There was a continuing interaction between England and continental Europe, and one of the most important European scholars to study here was Desiderius Erasmus, a Dutchman, who was a pioneer of the new Christian humanism in the Low Countries, which, it must be remembered, at that time united what are now Belgium and Netherlands into one political entity. We needn't go into great detail about his life and work, but we can confine ourselves to a brief account of his relationship with England and his main contribution to the interest of men like Colet in their new studies of the Bible. Colet and Erasmus were contemporaries, and both were influenced by that new learning that was coming out of Italy in the last decades of the 15th century. They were rather different in their temperaments, and, at first, in their interests. Colet's travels in France and Italy awakened in him a desire to understand the original meanings of the scriptures, whereas Erasmus, who had studied in Paris, started out with a devotion to the classics. Although he was sent to a monastery at an early age, Erasmus had been given permission to live outside the monastery, and in 1499 he visited England and spent some time in Oxford, where he met Colet. It was this meeting which sparked off his interest in the Bible, and in particular the Greek New Testament. He returned to Europe in 1500, but visited England on several occasions, and later became a great friend of Sir Thomas More, one of Colet's pupils, and later Henry VIII's Chancellor. Erasmus's great contribution to the growing interest in biblical scholarship was undoubtedly his Novum Instrumentum, published in 1516. This was a new Latin translation of the Bible, accompanied by a corrected Greek text with preface and notes. Now, we need say no more about Erasmus at this point, beyond saying a little more about his temperament. Whereas John Colet, or for that matter Thomas More, were both outspoken in their opinions and firm in their convictions, Erasmus was much more timid. His greatest desire was peace, and he had a deep distaste for controversy. It was only with the greatest reluctance, as in his later literary debate with Martin Luther on free will, that he came out into the open and expressed an opinion. First and foremost, he was a prolific scholar to whom later generations of biblical scholars were deeply indebted. So there we have it. A brief snapshot of the religious situation in England in the first years of the reign of Henry VIII. England was a traditional Catholic country, loyal to the Pope, but it was also a country where there had been a radical dissenting movement, owing its existence to the work and teachings of John Wycliffe. In his day, Wycliffe's calls for reform were radical and polemical, but in the first decades of Henry's reign, a more moderate reform movement, one which operated within the confines of doctrinal orthodoxy, had appeared under the inspiration of John Colet and his fellow Oxford humanists. And there was one final thing. Henry VIII saw himself as something of a theologian, because before the untimely death of his older brother Arthur, he had been intended for the priesthood, and it seems that his father had him in mind to be a future Archbishop of York. As we shall see in our next talk, Henry was to make use of this early training as he took on Martin Luther in a literary struggle. In our next talk, we shall also look at how Luther's ideas first came to England and how Henry and his ministers dealt with them.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Reformation in Great Britain with Pastor Roy Long. If you have any questions or comments concerning the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. Check our program online and stay tuned for more.